This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, June 28th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. This election season, we're running a series called The Challengers. Each month, we're looking at particular midterm races, focusing especially on candidates who are new to politics. We'll discuss upheavals in regions across the country and the issues that are shaping the futures of the two parties. This month, West Virginia and Virginia. President Trump carried West Virginia by more than 40 points, in large part by focusing on the plight of its coal miners. In the Senate, the state is represented by a Republican, Shelley Moore Capito, and a conservative Democrat, Joe Manchin, who is up for re-election this year. Manchin has gone out of his way to embrace the president. The state of Virginia went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and last year, in the statewide elections, a wave of progressive candidates carried the legislature, and a Democrat, Ralph Northam, won the governorship. The congressional races in Virginia this fall are key to Democrats taking over the House. In the 7th District, Abigail Spanberger, a former undercover CIA operative, has pretty much closed the gap with an incumbent Tea Party extremist, Dave Brat. In an interview on MSNBC, Spanberger attacked the political establishment for fostering vicious polarization.
We are not going to move this country forward. We are not going to be able to create impactful legislation that really affects people's lives if we are constantly fighting and prioritizing our political ideology over anything else. And so I do think that a major motivator for those of us who are first-time candidates is to be a part of just changing the conversation completely, bringing civility back to the discourse that's happening in Washington, and ensuring that we're working on behalf of the people, for me, in Virginia's 7th District, but overall, the people across this country.
Evan Osnos joins me to discuss the politics of the two states and what they say about the crises consuming both parties. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Dorothy.
Before we get to the races, tell us why you're interested in West Virginia and Virginia. How do they reflect larger political trends?
Yeah, they're both really fascinating pictures, and they're moving in opposite directions. So West Virginia was once a totally Democratic stronghold. You know, this was in fact, West Virginia was the state that basically made John F. Kennedy president. And once he was supporting West Virginia, people said this guy can win anywhere. It had this very strong relationship between labor unions and the Democratic Party, and that's changed dramatically over the last generation. It was basically Karl Rove in the 2000 election who peeled off the coal industry from the Democratic Party. He had people going around the state telling coal miners that Al Gore, who was then the Democratic nominee, was going to shut down the industry. And since then, West Virginia has moved very steadily in the direction of the GOP in a very weird way. So it's now today still formally, technically, there are many Democrats, but they are very conservative Democrats. West Virginia, in fact, today gives Donald Trump the highest approval rating of anywhere in the country, about 61%. And President Obama lost all 55 counties, which is a first for a presidential candidate of either major party. Virginia, which is just next door, has moved in very much the opposite direction. This was, after all, the capital of the Confederacy. But over the last 100 years, the percentage of native-born residents of Virginia, people who've spent their whole lives there, has dropped faster than in any other state. It's really become a destination for immigrants and for people from around the country, particularly into the prosperous suburbs around Washington, D.C. So you've got this real divide between the southern part of the state, which you will hear people describe it as the, quote, real Virginia, and the northern part of the state, which has become much more like the blue states up north. And Barack Obama, when he ran in 2008, was the first presidential candidate to win Virginia since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. So these two states, West Virginia and Virginia, if you put them together, you more or less have a portrait of this very polarized moment in America.
It's fascinating. Let's start with West Virginia. As I mentioned a minute ago, Joe Manchin, a Democrat, ostensibly, is up for re-election in November. listening to you talk about this recent history, I understand better about how West Virginia ended up sending a Democrat to the Senate and also why he has gone out of his way to embrace Trump, physically embrace him, yes. to the extent that, Trump made yeah. a joke about it.
Yeah, Trump said, you know, he in front of the whole Senate GOP caucus, Trump made a joke about Manchin trying to physically hug him as a way to get reelected. And Manchin defended himself, I should say. He said, well, he's pulling me in as much as I'm pulling him in. But Joe Manchin really does inhabit this predicament, right? I mean, he is a Democrat from West Virginia. He's got to mobilize the Democratic base in order to stay in office. But he is a pro-life Democrat, and he has been really going out of his way to side with Trump on some of the most divisive issues. So he endorsed CIA Director Gina Haspel, and he supported Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his confirmation. And he's really been quite supportive of many of Trump's immigration proposals. So Manchin is walking a very fine line in trying to get reelected here.
And how do his Democratic colleagues respond to all this? And what value is he bringing to the party if he's reelected?
Well, in some ways, you know, Joe Manchin is the Anthony Kennedy of the Senate. He's the vote. You know, this is the Joe Manchin Congress, because what he decides to do on a lot of issues can determine whether or not Democrats are able to resist Donald Trump. There are, as you know, 49 Democrats. That includes two independents who caucus with the Democrats. So if Manchin goes the other way, that becomes it becomes very hard for Democrats to get things done.
How tight is his race against Patrick Morrisey?
Right now, he's got a 6-point lead over Morrisey. Morrisey is a Republican who was attorney general in the state and has sort of tried to say that Manchin is not Trumpy enough. At one point, Morrison said, well, if you only vote with the president 60% of the time, that's not enough. So this is really an unusual race, but I think it is as good a reflection as any race in the country over the way that Trump is sort of refracting through partisan politics and the kind of reshaping of these two parties' characters.
So we heard Abigail Spanberger talk about civility, which is a nice sentiment. But in Virginia, Corey Stewart, the candidate Trump is supporting for Senate against Tim Kaine, is proudly running what he calls a vicious campaign.
Yeah. Well, Corey Stewart was one of the first indicators of the ways in which Trumpism as a political ideology was beginning to trickle down across the country, because he held a relatively insignificant local office. He was chairman of the Prince William County Board of Supervisors, it's a county about 45 minutes from Washington, D.C., which has become very diverse. And over the last few years, Stewart made a name for himself by trying to be a hardliner on immigration issues. So he ordered the police to check the immigration status of anyone who breaks the law. And he ran for governor last year, didn't make it. But when that really sort of was a wake-up call, I think, to a lot of Democrats about the ways in which candidates at the state level were going to be trying to capitalize on Trump's political energy. This time it looks like Corey Stewart is probably not going to win unless there's a big upset. Right now he's down about 18 points against Tim Kaine. The National Republican Senatorial Committee has signaled that it doesn't think that Stewart is worth investing in. They're not giving him any money. But assuming if the current trends hold and he doesn't win, what he represents is this persistent and very vocal and very aggressive form of confrontational Republican politics. He, by his own description, he says that he intends to be, as he puts it, ruthless and vicious, right? So at the moment, Tim Kaine is running in entirely the opposite direction. He is still using the image that has helped him in his career. The only political race he's ever lost was when he was vice presidential candidate alongside Hillary Clinton. And in Virginia today, he looks like he's on solid ground.
So we saw progressive Democrats make big strides in the statewide elections earlier this year. Abigail Spanberger, though, like many of the Democrats running for national office in the state, is running as a moderate. Is that right?
Yeah, she is. And She's an interesting person because she is a former CIA officer. She's the kind of person that never intended to run for office, as she said. And, you know, that sounds like a cliche in politics, but you're seeing that more persuasively this time than ever before. She is somebody who was really sort of motivated to run as a result of what's happening at the national level. But, you know, she is not running out on the progressive wing of the party. She is somebody who is much more of a, in many ways, a sort of familiar conventional Democratic candidate, except for the fact that she is somebody who has this very strong national security background and is using that as one of the ways that she's trying to springboard past Dave Brat, who everybody remembers was the big upset winner in 2014 over Eric Cantor.
Who himself, by the way, is worth pausing. Eric Cantor was hardly, you know, a country club Republican. So that alone is a sign of how far to the right the Republican Party has gone.
Yeah, there's an interesting parallel, too, which is, you know, nobody paid attention to that race in 2014. They said Eric Cantor is going to be impossible to beat. But Brat tapped into this very angry, very mobilized end of his party and won. That, you know, that dynamic that we saw in some ways in the Republican Party 4 years ago is now very much the dynamic that we see in the Democratic Party today. And that means that we don't exactly know where the party is going. It could end up being a much more progressive, more confrontational version of itself than it is today.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So the Republican Party nationally is now effectively the Trump Party. That's just a fact.
Yeah,
Democrats, as we are now seeing quite vividly, don't remotely share that cohesiveness. And it can be a strength.
Right.
It also can be a weakness. And there are these different factions within the party. Talk a little bit about the faction that Spanberger represents, which you and I have talked about as the kind of national security cohort.
Yeah. So there are a number of Democrats who come out of either the military or the intelligence community who are standing up and saying, look, there are fewer members of Congress today with combat experience than we've ever had. And they say, look, the last 17 years of American life, we have been at war ever since the attacks of 2001. And so it's time for people who have real hands-on credibility to enter national politics, and particularly on the Democratic side. And then within that community, and that encompasses, you know, people like Seth Moulton, congressman from Massachusetts, who's a former Marine, there's also particularly a number of women. That includes people like Amy McGrath in Kentucky, who was a Marine fighter pilot, went on to upset the two chosen Democratic candidate. And also in New Jersey, there's a Democrat named Mikey Sherrill, who's a former U.S. Navy helicopter pilot. And
can you just give us a quick recap of the numbers of women for House and Senate who are running this year from both parties?
Well, there's a huge number of women running this year. And so far, it's more than 500 who are running for the U.S. House and Senate, which is a 67% jump from just 2 years ago in 2016. Three quarters of them are Democrats. There are, in fact, no Republican women running for Congress in 14 states, which is a pretty remarkable measure of the divide. But it's worth discussing what the actual likely outcome is going to be, because the sheer fact of so many people running doesn't necessarily mean it's going to change the character of Congress. Out of the 100 members of the U.S. Senate, there are 22 women. And of the 435 people in the House, women members make up 83. So of the people who are running, the most optimistic scenario, when you factor in all of the pieces, like how many women are running against each other in various races and so on, the optimistic scenario would be that there could be another 50 or so women in Congress next January. Most likely, however, is that it'll be something closer to about another 17, 18, 20. So it's still very far from being equal representation, but it is a step in that direction. And it will change the Congress because, as we know, it's so tightly contested these days that one or two votes in either direction can really have a big impact.
And it's worth pointing out that we did see in the Obamacare debates how powerful just two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine,
right,
and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, how powerful they were in holding the line against total repeal. That was just an amazing thing to watch. So
yeah,
even tipping it with small numbers, it does seem indicative of a bigger political cultural change over time.
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, you've seen there's a lot that is riding on the shoulders of Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, whether we're talking about Obamacare and that vote, or now the question of what's going to happen to this seat that is going to be filled in the Supreme Court to succeed Anthony Kennedy. Because really, that vote will rest partly on the shoulders of Collins and Murkowski. It'll depend a little bit on whether some of these Democrats in red states decide to side with the president in order to defend themselves. But, you know, people are going to be watching closely. If Collins and Murkowski, who are both pro-choice Republicans, decide to break with their party on this, it will really set up a fight in the Senate over the president's nominee. Collins has said when she's been asked directly whether she wants to find somebody to succeed Kennedy who is like him, meaning that he's not in favor of overturning Roe v. Wade, she did not immediately say, yes, that's my priority. She said, I'm looking for a justice who will follow the law and the Constitution, which is a conspicuous reply in its absence.
Democrats are understandably in a state about this announcement, and the summer is clearly going to be dominated by the issue and whether Trump's nominee should be brought before the Senate, before the election, and the rest of it. But I wonder, There's also some worry among Democrats that the insurgency on the left is going to be harmful to the party. Do you agree with that?
Well, it depends how you define harmful. I think there is a real fear that pressure from the left is going to undermine the possibility of the Democratic Party being able to draw back independents who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. On the other hand, there is a pretty strong voice from within the Democratic Party that this is not just about progressive politics versus moderate policies. This is about a fundamental generational transformation of the Democratic Party that needs to happen. And it means thinking about new leadership at the top, somebody to succeed Nancy Pelosi. And if you're on that side, then you think that it's not harmful to the party, but is in fact an absolutely essential evolution that is going to guarantee its long-term health. But this is a genuinely live and unresolved issue today. I don't think there's anybody who can tell you with confidence that they know how it's going to break.
Thanks so much, Evan.
My pleasure, Dorothy. Thanks.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. We'll be off next week. Have a safe and happy 4th of July. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.